brucia la luna in cielo e io brucio d'amore.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is true.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway.
Buonasera, mi chiamo Eric.
This is Drew.
This is Brother Jay. I hate this movie.
All right, then. So... Tonight, we're talking about the 1990 blockbuster The Godfather, Part 3, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. So, Brother Drew, your final intro to The Godfather series?
Yeah, Godfather 3. If I had to sum it up, I'd say, come on, it's not that bad.
Brother Jay? I'm going to rely on you, Brother Jay, for a lot of this because... You hadn't seen any of the other ones all the way through, so you are the perfect...
I'm the pristine critic?
Yeah, yeah. So, just your opening thoughts on The Godfather Part 3.
My opening thoughts? I hated this movie.
Really? You didn't find anything redeeming about it?
No. It ended.
So,
I want my 3 hours back.
Well, we will note that you had made some predictions at the end of Godfather 2.
Uh-huh. And they were all true.
That's true. Yeah, all your predictions were correct. What were the predictions, if you'll remind us?
I said the movie was going to open with a party. And then there was going to be an assassination attempt. And then there would be some strife. And then there would be, like, a reckoning.
That is the pattern.
Yeah. We are all doomed to repeat patterns in life.
Are we? Are we, though?
Yes, we are.
Is that just the nature of man?
Indeed.
I'm establishing a new pattern this evening, so...
That's drinking Bacardi?
Bacardi Cherry.
Oh, I never heard of such a thing, but... anyway.
So... Yeah, I mean, I think this is certainly the least of the Godfather movies. And it has a really obtuse plot. I've seen it several times now, and I just now feel comfortable understanding, like, what is actually going on with the whole Vatican Bank thing. And this movie feels unpolished. And I know it had some production struggles. Including replacing a key actress at the last minute with somebody who may not have very much acting experience, which is kind of rough. But I think there's some good stuff here.
So who was replaced at the last minute?
Winona Ryder was supposed to be Mary Corleone. And she dropped out due to, I'm using finger quotes that the audience can't see, exhaustion. And so they replaced her at the last minute with Francis Ford Coppola's daughter.
Yeah, that explains why she was terrible.
I would have said terrible if I thought the performances of some of the other leads, I'm gonna have to admit to a little bit of Gina Davis syndrome here. I don't like Andy Garcia. I don't like him at all.
Turns out I'm not a big fan of him either. There's something about him I just want to smash his face in with the paperweight.
Yeah, and I could see where part of that is his character.
What was he in that made him, like, the bankable star that they wanted to restart the Godfather franchise with?
Well, wasn't the Meg Ryan movie... Was it before this or after this?
What Meg Ryan movie? Are you thinking of Nicolas Cage?
No, When a Man Loves a Woman.
Oh.
Oh, was that a hit? I don't think I ever saw that movie.
I don't know about a hit, but it was certainly he was given kudos for it. Actually, she was given kudos for it too. But yes, he played the husband, the very patient husband, to a alcoholic wife who is having a breakdown.
Huh. Yeah, he really lacked.
Are you looking that up, Jason?
Yeah, I'm looking it up.
He really lacked charisma in this movie.
Oh God, he was in Jennifer 8.
Oh, that's true.
He was in Dead Again. Dead Again.
Yes, yes, yes. Scissors.
American Roulette. He was in Untouchables.
Yeah. Can I just point out though that that an actor who I really like a lot, Joe Mantegna, is not good in this either.
Well, but he's not bad though. He's nowhere near as bad as Andy Garcia.
I think they're equally bad.
I do not see the movie you refer to under Andy Garcia.
When a Man Loves a Woman?
Oh, there it is. It's wedged in. It's after Jennifer 8. That's why I didn't see it.
When was it? What year was that?
94.
Oh, okay. Well, that was after this then.
Yeah. But by the way, you know, I worked at the theater when this movie opened, and I was there when it opened because it opened on Christmas Day.
I'm sure it was a thing.
It was a huge thing.
You know who was really good in this movie? Al Pacino and Diane Keaton. They were both great.
I think they were great in parts. But I think overall, I think Diane Keaton was actually solid in the whole movie because she didn't really honestly have a lot to work with. I think Al Pacino had some over-the-top moments, but that could have been direction. Well, we're going to talk about that. Jason was making a dramatic recreation of the ending.
Oh, no. I was recreating diabetic...
The stroke.
Yeah, that was like the palsy flop.
Yes. Ugh. Yeah. And this actually had a lot of weird casting. Like, who thought George Hamilton was a good idea?
He wasn't bad, though.
No, he had no lines.
No, he wasn't bad. He was just sort of a nothing character. That's another thing that really submarine this movie is they wouldn't pay Duvall to be Tom Hagen.
Yeah, I don't know. And I mean, I guess it was fun to see Bridget Fonda again because I'm actually quite fond of Bridget Fonda.
But she had almost no part and it was quick and over.
Yeah, it could have been anybody.
Well, like, what was the whole point of any of that?
To show you what a badass Vincent was. I like that they brought back the original Lucy Mancini. That was fun.
Oh, yeah. But, so shall we take a stab at the plot without going point by point, since that was roundly rejected as a bad tendency that I have?
I don't think that was... yeah, I appreciate you shouldering the blame, but I think we all fell into a bit of the comfort associated with just walking through the plot.
Okay. So I'm going to walk through some of the plot, but basically what we have now is the continuing story of Michael Corleone, who is now supposed to be approaching 60 years old, and he's trying to go legit, as theoretically he's been trying to for years. But this time he's not only trying to get good with the authorities, or just with legitimacy, but he's also trying to get good with God, presumably.
Yeah, he's grown the business enough that he opens with the establishment of a charitable foundation with an initial gift of $100 million.
They're throwing around big sums of money, and this is supposed to be 1979.
Yeah, so he's been extremely successful as a businessman up until now. That was a question I had for you guys. Do you have any sense for the time span of this movie? Because I do not, even after watching it a few times.
What, you mean like how long the movie took, or you mean when it started and like...
Like, did this take place over a couple weeks? Did it take place over a couple months? A year?
No, I don't know. It was No, it was about 40 years.
No, that's how much it felt like.
I'm not counting the very last scene.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's supposed to take place over, like, 6 months, maybe.
I'm sorry, from which movie to which movie? Are you saying this movie itself was just supposed to be 6 months?
Yeah, like, from the beginning of this movie.
Oh, the beginning of this movie to the end? No, I got that it was more like a couple of years. Because the Pope, he was straggling to die, I think it took him at least 8 months to die.
You think? I guess it could have been between the first opening party.
Yeah, so that's a problem. If none of us can really answer that question, that's a problem.
So we have the main characters where we have the party is actually when Michael is being given his... what is it called? He's being given named to the commander of the Order of Saint Sebastian.
Yeah, the Saint Sebastian Medal.
So this is a big deal. This is his $100 million buy-in to sainthood or whatever. Not sainthood, actually, just legitimacy. But he is having this party following the ceremony. And we have all the main characters attending the party, pretty much. We have Kay, Diane Keaton, who is bringing her adult children, Anthony, played by Frank D'Ambrosio, and Mary, played by Sofia Coppola. Now, I was really distracted by the actor Frank D'Ambrosio. Do you know anything about him, or were you distracted?
No.
Okay. He reminded me of a young Mark Ruffalo.
I can see that.
And he had hardly any lines, but then he had this tremendous singing part at the end. It turns out that's because he is a Broadway star. He is actually known as the Iron Man in the Mask. He has played the Phantom of the Opera. He has played the Phantom more than 2,000 times.
Okay, so that was really him singing then. Nice.
Oh, I've seen him in many other things, so not in movies.
He's a legit singer.
Because his IMDb credit only lists this movie.
Yeah, because he's done most of his time on Broadway. I think most for the San Francisco... I'm not sure what you'd call it, in the San Francisco theater community. So basically what we have is Sophia, who is the president of, or the vice president of, the Michael Corleone, the Vito Corleone Foundation. So it's charitable works and stuff, right?
Yes.
So she is the figurehead. She is the Ivanka Trump. And Anthony is supposed to be going into the family business as well and being a lawyer, but he doesn't want to be a lawyer. He wants to be a singer. And Michael has a problem with that because it's stupid. And, you know, as a father now, I can kind of understand that conversation a little better than beforehand. Because he's like, okay, I don't care what you do. Just you need to get your law degree.
Yeah. So this opening part is, it sets up a lot of stuff. It sets up that Mary is a lot closer to her father than Tony is. It sets up that Kay and Michael have not really reconciled over the years. Kay's still pretty upset about him. And it also sets up that Michael is really kind of softened. He's sold all the criminal aspects of his empire. And he's really trying to go legit, and at the same time he doesn't really want anything to do with the wise guys. And he wants his children to be legitimate members of his organization.
Well, he doesn't want anything to do with the wise guys except that he's making a $100 million contribution to a charitable contribution, which is basically just still a big bribe to the church.
True. But I think he's looking for redemption. He wants to be redeemed. He wants to be absolved of his sins, and not just by God or the church, but also by Kay. And I mean, you know, he basically wants to be forgiven for ordering his brother killed. That's a big plot point.
Yes.
So, in the meantime, we meet some other people. The Archbishop Gildy, played by Donald Donnelly, is the basically the person he's contributing all this money to, and his main contact within the Catholic Church, like the liaison. And also we have Vincent Mancini, played by Andy Garcia, who is Sonny Corleone's illegitimate son with Lucy Mancini.
Vincenzo.
Yeah, and he shows up at the party.
Wearing an awesome jacket.
Yes, he is wearing a nice jacket, yes.
I don't care what you say about the movie. That jacket was awesome.
Needed some fringe.
And he is the bad boy. He's a tough guy, but he's a young tough guy. And he certainly catches the eye of lots of the ladies, especially the younger ladies, especially
Mary. The ones he's related to.
Yes, Mary, his cousin. And they call each other cuz all the time, which is creepy.
It's more creepy when they're doing it.
Well, there's that.
Yeah, it's one thing to carry on like this, you know, borderline incestuous relationship with your first cousin. But then to call each other cuz, that's just really bad form.
Yeah, exactly. It's just...
You know, you're already pushing the envelope. Why you gotta spit in our faces about it?
Well, or maybe that's part of the attraction. Who knows? Yeah, unfortunately, this event, because apparently all gatherings in the Corleone family, the godfather has to be asked for favors.
He tries to refuse this one.
Yeah.
He does not want it.
Oh, no, he doesn't want it at all. Yeah. So he entertains Joey Zaza, which, of course, I didn't like the name either. Everything was wrong with this. For some reason, Joe Mantegna did not have the darkness, maybe. Maybe because he's trying to be polite, but there's no sinister edge to him. I just thought he was miscast.
His bodyguard was sinister enough.
Oh, yeah. No, his bodyguard was super sinister.
He played the same role in Bugsy.
And on The Simpsons.
And in Joan of Arcadia.
Yeah, so... It just was out of place in this movie, yeah, is all.
Exactly. So we have a nice scene, I guess, where Michael tries not to intervene, but ends up having to defend, because basically, Joey Zaza is rude and is kind of a smarmy bastard. Or no, sorry, not a bastard. That's Vincent, who's a bastard. Literally. That's right. And Vincent is unhinged in a Mike Tyson fashion, where he bites off part of Joey Zaza's ear.
Yeah, there's a fun moment later on. I think it's when they're in Sicily, when he's watching a little puppet show. And I guess biting an ear is like a Sicilian thing. I don't know. But in the puppet show, one of the puppets bites the ear of his enemy. Or maybe it was during the opera. I forget. But there was just a funny reaction shot of him being like, hey, yeah, I did that.
Well, it's a very intimate kind of attack, because it's a very intimate insult.
You've just been Van Gogh'd.
Yeah, in the background, by the way, Connie, Talia Shire, is great. I thought she was actually going to be much more like a Machiavellian character.
Did either of you watch The Sopranos for any length of time?
No, never seen it.
For the first couple, I thought you guys saw the first four seasons.
So you watched it long enough to meet Tony's sister Janice?
Yes.
So Connie kind of reminded me of a Janice Soprano, who was more put together. But Janice was always getting in the ear of the people around her, being like, oh, you know, you could be boss. You should be boss. You just need to do these things.
Yeah, I thought at the end Connie was going to have a hit put on Michael.
Yeah, I kept expecting her to pull daggers out from her skirt.
She was badass.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I thought her performance was great.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically have, we have, you know, of course, since they didn't get Tom Hagen back, we have Tom Hagen's son, played by John Savage, who is a priest who is going to be sent off to work at the Vatican. And we have, let's see, we have in the consigliere role, we have B.J. Harrison, George Hamilton, who, by the way, B.J. Harrison is the actual name of a very prolific audiobook narrator. So I don't know if you've heard any, like, there's a podcast he used to do that basically where he would read the classics. And he has, like, 7 million downloads of his recorded voice. So he's very good. You can buy collections on Audible. But, yeah. So if you ever want to listen to a classic, he's a good author. B.J. Harrison. And I did
because I need to give Audible more of my money.
A lot of these things are free, available. If you look at, I think it's, just look up B.J. Harrison Classics, and you'll find it. Do not look up just B.J. Classics. You'll get a wholly different search results there.
Thanks.
So,
what do you get?
Make sure that my safe search is on.
There you go. So, I didn't realize until I was doing my due diligence that the spokesman for the Corleone Foundation, who basically hangs around a lot with B.J. Harrison in the background of the scenes, is played by Guido Sarducci, Father Guido Sarducci. I forget his actual name.
Yeah, he seemed really familiar, and I could not place him.
Yes, yes. You could definitely try to find a Pope in a pizza. I think his character name was Don Abbondo, and he was supposed to be like a relative of Jenko Abbondo, but they didn't really develop that too much.
And then the one last character you meet at this party is Eli Wallach playing Don Altobello.
Yes.
Yeah, that was kind of jarring for me.
Well, Eli Wallach, freaking legendary actor from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and the original Mr. Freeze on the 1967 Batman. And the goal, the whole plot behind this is that the big plan for Michael is he wants to have the Corleone Foundation become the primary shareholder in this international company called Immobiliare.
Yeah, he wants the operating interest. So he wants to be in control. And to do this, he's going to leverage some shady dealings done by the Vatican Bank and provide them enough money to bail themselves out of a horrific amount of debt, the kind of debt that could actually topple the bank.
Yes. And the debt that was nefariously mishandled.
Yes.
Embezzled, really.
Yeah.
So connected to Immobiliare, because this movie didn't have enough people in it, is a couple other important characters. That one guy and then the other guy.
You mean
yes, Lucchese, and then
Cardinal Lamberto?
No, not Lamberto. The
banker.
The actual banker dude who I think is based on a real life guy, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's see.
I think there was a Thinking Sideways podcast about the real life dude.
Was it Kinzig, right?
Yes.
Yes.
He was the Vatican banker.
Yeah, because he was played by Helmut Berger.
Sounds right.
Yeah. So, basically, we do have kind of a retelling of the familiar Corleone story. We have a little bit of infighting in the family, because, of course, Vincent is causing trouble. But Michael is loyal to him. And we have this whole dealings with the Vatican, where they're going to transfer $600 million to the Vatican Bank. And then he learns when Michael visits Vatican City, he learns that there's these influential parties that are opposing the deal. And the Pope has to personally sign off on this deal. And unfortunately, Pope Paul VI dies before the deal can be done. Well, he's very sick at first and then eventually dies.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Don Altobello.
And this is B.J. Harrison, played by George Hamill. And this is what he's really great at. He's really great at being like the blunt, like Asperger's dude who, when, you know, they're in this room full of, you know, ostensibly super religious Catholics talking about the sick Pope, he's the one who's like, hey, what does this do for the deal if he dies? And like everyone's like, hey,
yeah, exactly.
Slow your roll there, lawyer. We're praying for his health right now.
So in the background of all this, we've got Joey Zaza trying to take out Vincent with Bridget Fonda in the room. And you see the coldness of Vincent, which I thought was actually, you know, the scene of him dispatching the assassins
the scene of him dispatching his girlfriend, potentially having her murdered by the hitman.
Well,
he didn't care about that broad.
Give me some water. His girlfriend. Yeah.
Go give me some water. I'm thirsty.
So, and then we have Michael, who is in fairly poor health. He just certainly does not look like 60. Maybe he is a guy of 47. I'm looking at 60 thinking, I hope I look better than that when I'm 40, when I'm 60. But, but he is trying to, completely disassociate himself from all criminal enterprises. So he gathers the leaders of all the families.
Yeah, well, he has to, because Altobello tells him that the rest of the families want in on this Immobiliare deal, and they are upset that he's shutting them out.
Yes.
So he calls them together to make peace, because he is going to keep this deal legitimate, and he's not going to let them in on it.
And he's going to pay them off handsomely. Well, except for one notable example. So he goes there on purpose to this hotel, in a scene that I remember seeing in the theater, where he hands all these mob bosses these gigantic checks, except for Joey Zaza. And so Joey Zaza gives him the malocchio and exits the room quickly, and Don Altobello runs after him to try to make peace.
Yeah, I mean, and these payments are their percentages from the casinos that the families owned together that the Corleones ran, and the Corleones sold them. So,
and these are huge figures.
Yeah, like $50 million to one of the families.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, Michael is paying them out of his own pocket while it sounds like the deal is still going through. He called it cutting through the red tape to make the peace. But yeah, Joey Zaza is new enough that he had not actually owned any interest in the casinos.
He clearly hadn't invested in his retirement program yet.
That's right. So he was, yeah, a little ticked off.
Yeah, and Vincent made a show of not giving him anything. So he leaves in a huff. But in his place arrives a helicopter that shoots up the entire top floor of the conference room in this hotel.
Very conspicuous.
Very dramatic, yes. I wonder if somebody came back and picked up all the checks.
Well, I would say the checks at that point were moot.
Yeah, I suppose.
Saved him a lot of money.
It did. It did. But then it's like becoming like, it's like, is it time to go to the mattresses? Like, what do you do? But they go back to the apartment in New York. And Michael's considering how to respond. And is this where he has his very, very famous, most quoted thing from this movie?
Yes.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
So, Jason, you have not seen this movie before, but surely you'd heard this line.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, I heard the line. When I heard the line, I instantly was like, oh, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has this diabetic stroke thing, which, yeah, is pretty much Fred Sanford, Elizabeth level acting, actually. Maybe not. Maybe the whole thing is supposed to be operatic. Maybe that's why the acting is really forced. It's not subtle.
Well, that part of the movie was sort of on the nose. You know, the first two movies had been described as having like operatic climaxes. So they didn't want to think too hard about this third one, so they actually made it an opera.
So Michael is then hospitalized, and Vincent and Mary begin their romantic relationship in earnest. By the way, I thought that maybe Vincent and Connie were also going to have the romantic relationship in earnest at the same time. But apparently, you only can have one incestuous relationship at a time.
Connie goes like full on Santino, though.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, Michael's in the hospital. Kill them all.
Yeah, so Vincent's up for it. And they have a scene very reminiscent of Godfather 2, where Vito kills the Don, Don Fanucci or whatever.
Yeah, because I'm just like Fanucci. I wrote it down. I'm like, gee, I was going to say that this movie just kind of followed the formula, but it actually just followed the same script because it killed him at the same carnival.
So you think it was a less homage than just a ripoff?
Yeah. Lazy writing.
I'd say deliberate parallelism.
So after Vincent kills Zaza, and then when Michael finds out, he's not happy with Vincent. But Vincent and Michael have this arrangement where basically Michael says, Vincent, you're going to be, you know, you're being next in line. You're going to be the new Godfather. But in order to do that, you have to give up my daughter.
That is much, much later.
Is it much later?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's when they're in Italy. So, yeah. So at the same time that this is happening, Michael's also getting squeezed by Lucchese and Kleinzig. And Cardinal, what's his name? The Immobiliare deal is getting stalled. So I know what they're trying to do here, and I thought it was an interesting concept, and the concept that they were trying to explore is that there really is no legitimacy, especially when you get to the upper levels of, you know, global corporate finance, is that he's trying to divest himself of his gambling and his prostitution and his rackets to be legitimate, but then he winds up encountering what he considers like to be even more ruthless and insidious criminals.
It's all organized crime.
Yep, and I think that's a really interesting theme. They kind of whiffed on it, but I like what they were trying to do there, because you know it is very similar to the first movie, especially in the second movie a little bit, but you know in the first movie the reckoning was all about rival mobsters, and in this movie the enemies and the ones who reap the whirlwind at the end at the hands of the new Don Corleone, they are just as criminal, but they are considered to be legitimate businessmen. So they're not gangsters, they are businessmen, but you know, it's the same cycle all over again, just in a different sphere.
Well, and theoretically he should be, I mean, this is right up his alley.
He just doesn't realize that he's supposed to still be playing that game. He thought everything was on the up and up.
I think he did. I think he realized it. I just think he was frustrated and was hoping that it wasn't that way. He didn't want it to be like that.
Right, exactly.
Because he was railing against it, but he was fighting, you know, rage against the machine.
And like you said, Eric, earlier, having it be like this Vatican deal, to tie in with the Corleone Catholic faith, also brought in Michael's redemption arc, or his desire to be redeemed. So the business end sort of ties in with the personal journey that he's on, And that he goes on with Kay. And that was actually my favorite part of the movie, is when he's really trying to reconcile with Kay. I thought there was some really good stuff from Al Pacino and Diane Keaton in their scenes together.
Yeah, there was a couple of things that were really good. I mean, the where he played taxi driver was fantastic.
Well, that's the first time in all three movies that he shows genuine affection for Kay. I think, Jason, you pointed out, in the, even in the first movie, he doesn't really demonstrate a lot of affection for Kay like he does with Apollonia.
Yeah, exactly. She's just, you know, she's just basically there to squirt out the kids.
Yeah, and to kind of, you know, that's, he has to have a wife, so that's what he's going to have.
Exactly.
So, in this case, he, though, I mean, he, you really do get a sense of, you know, they're kind of playing. Like, she's reluctant at first because she doesn't trust him, which she shouldn't because he had his brother killed and is otherwise a bad guy. But, you know, he's an imp. He's about 5 seconds from putting a piece of orange in his mouth and chasing a child around the vineyard.
Yeah, and later in the movie you have Connie, who, a total revisionist history. Where she says, you know, it was an accident. The accident.
Oh, yes, Fredo's accident.
She doesn't believe that, though.
But she wants to believe it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's 100% denial.
Oh, but families are like that, though. That's the best thing.
No, they are not.
Well, I don't mean our family, necessarily. I'm just saying that, you know, hey, whatever myth gets you through your life, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So, they go back to Sicily, and part of the Sicily trip is that Tony is going to be singing opera. And it's a big deal. And so everybody's going to that. And he's actually performing in Corleone, Sicily?
Yes.
But when Michael gets to Sicily, he kind of gets the lay of the land, and he sends Vincent on a spy mission, which Vincent accepts. That he's going to go to Don Altobello, who he has figured out.
It's like a triple cross.
Yeah, Michael has figured out that Altobello wasn't just a coincidence that he ran out of the room before the big old shootout at the hotel.
Oh, come on. You knew he was, I knew he was the villain from the first time he was on screen.
Because Joey Zaza is not smart enough to have pulled that off.
Yeah.
Again, it was the,
Well, Michael said as much.
Yeah.
Telegraphing the entire plot. Not much subtlety. Might have just been like 1,000 pairs of scissors.
You mean during his diabetic seizure? When he's yelling Altobello, you fuck.
So, and of course, then we meet with Cardinal Lamberto, who's the pious priest, who...
I just thought he looked related to the guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Which guy? The guy who ends up melting at the end?
Yes.
I really liked Lamberto.
Oh, me too.
I thought he was really good. I mean, he got Michael to actually give confession, and then at the end it was like, you're gonna keep suffering.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, dude.
It's like, so confess, and Michael keeps going. Lamberto's like, oh, well, this is worse than I thought, huh? but also, at this point, we have a little, when Michael's diabetic, Michael is really diabetic, man. He gets the low blood sugar in a hurry. He's got to eat candy and drink orange juice in a quick hurry.
You don't think that was a put-on?
Oh, you think it was a put-on?
Yeah, I think it was a put-on.
Okay.
To make him seem desperate. To make him get the kind of the concern and affection of the priest, so he could take confession right there, and that way, you know, he was kind of endeared in the future to the future pope.
That's funny. I didn't think it was a put on, but I might be a Michael apologist.
Yeah, I just thought
except
it was
for his except for his manners, because he needs to chew with his fucking mouth closed. That was disgusting.
We still have that misophonia episode or segment that we're going to put it at some point. I'm not making fun of misophonia, by the way. I'm just saying that we haven't actually talked about it.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's an empirical fact that that open mouth chewing is disgusting.
So yeah, so but you're right. Lombardo tells him that that it is just that Michael suffers, and that he could tell Michael to repent, but he's not going to because he knows it won't happen anyway. So that is the
yeah.
So Lombardo is he's not naive, but yeah. But then you have the little fun in Sicily with Michael and Kay, and it's all very exciting, and they both admit that they still love each other. But but then we have this famous assassin that's been hired to kill Michael
by Altobello.
Yes.
And the assassin and his sidekick, Donkey Boy.
Yes, the Donkey Boy guy was bad. It was bad.
You don't say.
He pulled his bottom lip out. Ugh. So, yeah. But the assassin ends up killing Don Tomasino. And that's the new round of violence is going to begin. And this is all culminating, and I'm probably yada-yadaing some stuff, but please interrupt.
Well, you're yada-yadaing my favorite K moment in any of the three movies, where like she's finally like having like a reconciliation moment with Michael, and they touch hands, and her sturdy facade is crumbling, and she's just about to give in to his charms when Callo comes to get Michael to tell him that Don Tomasino has been murdered. And you can just kind of see her sort of off center in the frame through the door, you know, muttering to herself that it's never going to end.
The wall just goes right back up.
Oh yeah, she's Joan Cusack in In and Out. Is everybody gay?
Yep. Yep. In this world, everybody is gay. Yes. Metaphorically.
I love Joan Cusack. Yeah, so now we have some bloodshed.
Some bloodshed. Good God, don't go to the Italian opera.
No. But, I mean, Vincent comes back and lets know that what Altobello said, that Lucchese is against the Immobiliare deal. And this assassin known as Mosca di Montelpri has been hired by Altobello to kill Michael. And Vincent wants to strike back. But Michael's like...
This is where Michael gives him the Corleone name and tells him that he has to give up his daughter if he wants to be part of this.
And he says yes. And you don't really think that he's 100% trustworthy about that. Vincent. Because he's a smirker. You can't never trust a smirker.
I don't know. Part of me thinks that he was chasing around after the daughter to see if he could just use that as leverage to get into the family. Because that's, you know, that's a pretty guiling way.
Literally get into your own family to get into your own family.
Exactly.
So he wanted to wed Mary and take her name.
Exactly. There you go.
No, I think he knew that Michael wouldn't stand for it, and he knew that he could convince the daughter. You know, he could do a convincing job of swooning her, and he knew Michael wouldn't stand for it. And you know, Michael's only leverage and bargaining power would be true power,
or he could have him killed. Either one of those.
Except this is a kindler, gentler, soft, squishy, spongy Michael.
Not when he needs some OJ.
Yeah, it's true. So then we go to the opera. And it's a very operatic scene, including some weird comedy. Like, the assassin guy has some kind of comedy. and brutal brutality at the same time. Also, what's up with the twins?
They're stupid.
No, but why did you need to have twins? It just seemed weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
And especially after last week's episode, where I during some heavy editing, I rediscovered the magic of the crash test dummies.
Oh God!
I could see those twin guys turning to each other and saying,
So this opera made me think of like old style construction projects. You know, especially the massive ones like Hoover Dam or Mount Rushmore, where you just sort of build into the budget and the schedule, like how many people are going to die during the project. I wonder if anytime they have like a big gathering in Sicily, they just like assume that, you know, this is probably like a 6 murder event.
Is this the cost of doing business?
Yeah, I mean, it's Italy, you know? What are you going to do? You're going to get people together and people are going to get murdered.
Yeah, I mean, Gino the casket maker has to make a living too.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to see more of this opera than I thought we were going to, but it's not unpleasant. I mean, again, the singing is good.
Are you kidding? The opera was mimicking the rest of the movie.
Oh, it was. It was. Yep. But and then we have interspersed
a lot of dead bodies at this opera. Good God, never go to an opera in late.
Yeah, true.
Exactly.
But then we get to see behind the scenes we have these other deaths happening. We see Keinzig being killed. We see Archbishop Gilde being poisoned. I'm sorry. He is actually poisoning the Pope. And then Don Altobello eats poison cannoli that Connie feeds him.
Oh, like a boss. She has a whole narrative when she gives it to him. And she even takes a bite herself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Now, she faked the bite.
Even better.
Yeah, she never took the bite. She faked it. It was good. It was a good stage bite, but she never bit into it.
Yeah. Al-Niri shoots Gilde as he's climbing up the spiral staircase, and the bodies are thrown down the stairs in kind of an Alfred Hitchcock Vertigo kind of style. Wah!
It would have been really great if Coppola had like cut to one of those like spinny effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Right then. The Vertigo effects.
Yeah. Yep.
So then we have the Corleone button man, Callo, who goes after Don Lucchese and stabs him in the throat with his own eyeglasses.
Yeah, because he couldn't carry a weapon in because he was pat down.
Yeah.
And that was the same actor who played Callo in Godfather, right?
I'm guessing. And then, of course, you know, Callo dies for his trouble. But then at the very end, well, no, that's the problem with this movie, by the way. I'm going to contend right here. Spoiler for my irritation with this movie. We're reaching this climax of the opera. We're reaching the climax of the movie. We have the assassin coming to kill Michael. We've got a lot of tense scenes. We have the assassin killing the twins, Carlos and Rogerio Miranda.
The scenes were tense? You thought this was a tense movie?
This is the same day when we find out the Immobiliare deal has been ratified. So Michael's won.
Yes.
So yeah, so he has to die now.
Yes. But instead, there's a little bit of, assassins gets foiled from killing Michael like he should have, like Abe Lincoln style. And instead, he has to shoot Michael like on the stairs outside the opera house. But unfortunately, the first shot hits Michael in the shoulder, and the second hits Mary in the chest.
Oh, I thought it went through Michael.
Oh, through Michael into Mary? Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Because then Michael eventually takes revenge by swapping faces with the assassin. No? Okay, never mind.
Okay.
Conversation for another time.
All right. You leave me hanging?
It was a face-off reference. Yes. more obscure than I thought, apparently.
Okay, yeah.
I laughed.
Okay. Yeah, so then Vincent kills the assassin, and Michael has the primal, like, nothing comes out vocally scream until eventually he does actually have a real scream. And that, by the way, boom, that's where the movie should end. Credits roll, fade to black. That's where it should end. The wages of sin are death and misery, and that's what happened. That should be the whole story. Michael was corrupted. Michael tried to go right. Too bad. Didn't work. Got pulled back in. Daughter dies. Boom. He's doomed. But no, they continue the movie.
I know exactly what happened, though. So they had the ending that you described, and they were all high-fiving each other and giving each other fist bumps and even blowing it up. And then someone was like, oh, holy crap. We forgot to have some oranges in that last scene.
And son of a bitch. That wasn't Al Pacino too, was it? Who was in Johnny Dangerously?
Michael Keaton.
Yeah, but was he the... Oh, because Joe Piscopo was Johnny Dangerously.
I thought Michael Keaton was Johnny Dangerously and Joe Piscopo was the bad guy.
Son of a bitch.
Before we begin the questions, my client would like to read from the prepared statement.
Go ahead. I would like to direct this to the distinguished members of the panel. You lousy corksuckers. You have violated my Fargan rights. This Samanambaching country was founded so that the liberties of common patriotic citizens like me could not be taken away by a bunch of Fargan ice holes like yourselves. Thank you very much.
By the way, I think that's a movie all three of us saw in the theater together.
Oh, probably. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, we get this weird montage of Michael's memories where he's seen dancing with Mary and dancing with Apollonia and dancing with Kay. And then we have Michael sitting in his Sicilian villa as an old man. And he drops an orange from his hand and collapses in the stupidest death scene ever. I thought the death scene where Marlon Brando fell down in front of the little kid in a garden. Actually, it wasn't really a vineyard necessarily, but that was kind of over the top and dramatic. But this scene was horrible. This scene was when we talk in a month or so about Pee Wee Herman's, Paul Reubens' famous death scene in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I thought this was equivalent to that.
Yeah, I mean, I know what they're trying to do here. They're trying to show Michael dying alone, having lost everything. Because he said repeatedly the only thing that mattered to him was his family. And he was spending most of this movie trying to get them back. And almost did it. And then surely the rest of his family blamed him for Mary's death. So I think we're supposed to understand that he lived out his days alone. And that's supposed to be tragic, but...
No, I mean, I get it. The first movie is Michael getting his family. The second movie is Michael completely shutting off his family and losing his family one way or another. And this movie is supposed to be the redemption or his attempt at redeeming his family or reuniting with his family. And it doesn't work out because he's a flawed character. But he should have ended it
turns
screaming.
It turns out he sucks at it.
Yeah, he's flawed.
Mm-hmm.
So, have we redeemed it for you, Brother Jay? Is this now in your redeemed list of judgment? It?
No. It's a terrible movie.
It's not that bad.
It's terrible. It's not worth having seen. I would have been happy watching the first two. I would have walked away and been like, eh, not too bad. But now I'm just like, oh, this is pointless.
Does it make the first two better?
Only by comparison. Okay. But that's like lining up Hitler, Goebbels, and Goering.
So, Brother Drew, was
wait,
it worth it?
Which one of those makes the other two better by comparison?
I'm just saying, it depends on how you line them up.
No. That's true. You get to rank them. Rank your nazis. Yeah. We can do them by height.
This is thought experiment. No, I think this movie is worth seeing, especially if you've seen the first two in the trilogy. It whiffs on a lot of stuff, but it really tries, and it has some interesting moments. Has some good moments, has some really terrible moments, but the effort was there. I mean, a lot of energy was spent on consistency. You know, the really minor stuff, like Michael pulling Vincent into the family photo, just like he did with Kay in the first movie. Little things like that. Bringing back minor characters like Callow and Lucy. Having Al Neary still in it. You know, tying everything up completely really made Robert Duvall's absence, that more transparent. So, yeah, I mean, this is certainly the worst of the three, but it's worth seeing.
Well,
absolutely.
It really was trying to combine the first two, because it had the deliberately paced party scene in the beginning. It had the assassination attempt, over the top kind of thing in the middle, but it also had going to Sicily, like in the second movie. And so they had that kind of, like, going to Sicily is almost like going back in time. So, yeah, I agree. I get what it was trying to do, and it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I mean, I already told you the performances I was bagging on, but overall, it wasn't all that bad. I mean, I think it was probably a B movie. Not a B movie, but, you know, a grade B movie. Maybe a three-star movie. Whereas the first two are easily four-star movies.
And here's one thing that I thought it did well. The progression, I thought, was done very well. So the first movie was a New York movie. The second movie expanded the empire sort of, bicoastally and a little bit internationally with Cuba. And then by the time the third movie rolled around, it expanded the scope globally, but still maintain the same sort of family thread. Which is what you want in subsequent sequels, right? You want the scope to be expanded without losing the original impetus for the story in the first place. And I thought it did that well.
Wait, okay. Okay, picture this. Elevator pitch right here. Okay? Godfather 4.
I'm in.
Okay. We have Andy Garcia, shouldn't be too expensive to get. He is now the aging Godfather Corleone. They are trying to leverage and get a corner on the first missions to Mars. They're trying to be like Corleone Galactic. So they're trying to get not necessarily like a corner on the market of like land on Mars, but more like the manufacturing processes for the transports to Mars and the terraformers and stuff. And they're going to need catering for the crews that go up to Mars. And all of that can be done by the Corleone family if they can get on it early. Let somebody else, let the Richard Bransons of the world be in charge of Virgin Galactic, but Corleone Galactic could be, it's like the gold rush. Yeah. The gold rush, there's a certain amount of people that found gold and made money, but the people who really made money were the people that were selling shovels.
But this is only after you sit through a 40-minute lunar party of people wandering around.
There's got to be a launch party, absolutely. A launch party where there's some retirements into the zero-G lounge versus people asking favors of the Godfather. And there'll be an assassination, mm-hmm. some sort of laser fight assassination.
Yep, that ends up in a disaster where they're not sure how they're going to survive, but at least they have poop and potatoes, so there's hope.
I haven't seen that movie either, but yeah, hey, whatever takes you through the day there.
It's a great movie.
Okay, I'll just take
that's
your word for
a great
it.
Movie.
Anyway, okay, so Godfather 4, we're all in. I expect a treatment by Christmas. It's National Script Writing Month, right? In November.
Shock treatment.
oh, come on.
Shock treatment. That was a terrible movie. Yes, surely Godfather 3 is better than Shock Treatment.
Oh, come on.
Marginally.
Little Black Dress.
Ever since I was a little boy, dressing up has always been my greatest joy. But when it's time to be discreet, there's one thing you just can't beat. And that's a strapless, backless, classical little black dress. Well, first you go rip, rip, rip. Then you go snip, snip, snip. Then you whip it and zip, zip, zip. I split it up to the hip, hip, hip. And as you strip, 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 you shiver and quiver for that soft caress as you slip, slip, slip into that little black dress.
Godfather 3, starring Bridget Fonda. Who appeared in Jackie Brown with Sid Haig. Who was in Kill Bill Volume 2 with David Carradine. Who was in 1972's Boxcar Bertha with John Carradine. Who was in Golden Rendezvous with Robert Beatty. Who was Dr. Richard Halverson in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Banana. I think these Space Odyssey things will have to end at the end of 2016. Send your feedback to show at notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.